We just have 20 minutes. It's boomy, this net. We have about 20 minutes till lunch. And so this is just an opportunity for you to make a comment or ask a question, and then I'll find someone to answer the question. Okay? So that's how we'll do it. So it's a bit vulnerable here. So if you want to ask a question or make a comment, that was quick. Okay. Yes. Can we put this down just a little bit? Yeah.
Nick, you talked quite a lot about sort of leadership being about empowering people to do things, you know, rather than controlling.
Yeah.
So I love that. However, we were having a discussion in our group about loads of the people that you would like to see doing stuff are already drowning stuff in them, running house groups, running small groups.
Yeah.
And it feels like you're just dumping even more on them. So I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Yeah, and people today have less time on their hands because most people are working all hours.
Yeah.
And we're in great danger. I mean, you notice the stats, particularly from done in the States, when they've done research as to why people leave churches, it isn't because they're out of love with Jesus. They leave because they're usually good, committed, Jesus-loving people, but they know if they joined another church, their life will be taken away because they want to be committed. So they leave not because their faith's gone, but because they want a life. And we're greatly in danger, I think, of dumping things on people so that they don't have a life. Now, it could be that some of the things we're dumping on people is because we think these are things we ought to have in the church. And so we've got to find someone to run it. Now, there are things like children's ministry and stuff which are very difficult to have if you don't have that. But when somebody themselves feels, this is something I feel called to do and gifted to do, they will run with it for a long time. When they're asked to do something to help you out, usually they'll get tired and they'll give up on it. But because we are so keen to have all the jobs filled, we grab people to do it. It's better to have the job taken than somebody feel it's their gifting. So a lot of the jobs in the church are run by people who would feel they're doing it to help us out rather than in any way. And in some ways, it would be better to stop some things. Cut down, don't have the house groups, it's just not working, it's just killing people, and tell people, feel themselves, that they want to gather a group of people and run something. So I think the danger is that we run too many events, and therefore we're spinning the plates that too many people are having to do it, and we might be better to cut down on a lot of what we do. Because most people should have, what we say to them, we want you to have time with your non-Christian friends and to go out and do all that sort of stuff, and they say, well, when can we possibly do that? Because our whole life's taken up with church, and that's really would be criminal if that were the case, I think. But what you're saying is echoed across this room, and we feel the burden of it as leaders because we want to see that all these things go on in the church. But the danger is it's our agenda, and I think we have to take a step back. And I know what it's like. Beginning of the year, we haven't got enough children's workers. Please, would somebody like to step up to the plate and do some just for a year? That's all we're asking of you, just for 1 year, 1 day a week. But then somebody else is asking those keen people, because they're usually the keen ones, could they please also lead a house group? And would they be willing to serve coffee on another Sunday? And after a bit, people go, I don't think I want to be doing this. And so it's a very big question. I think it's very important that we take every individual almost and say, well, what are you doing? Are you doing more than one thing you're serving in? Is it an area which gives you life, or does it sap the energy out of you? So this part of discipleship, I remember a guy from California saying to me, he's a very good friend of mine, said, what's really important is that you don't use the person to get the job done. You use the job to get the person done. And in other words, you say, you're doing this because I think this is really going to help you grow in your discipleship. But the bigger the church, the more difficult that is to do, because you've got too many people to look after. But thank you for the question. I don't have the answer, but it's the right question. I think an energized church will be a church where people are doing the thing. Ultimately, some people got to do stuff they don't want to do. But generally speaking, people are doing the thing that they feel God has gifted and called them to do. And they found that area. And then I think you'll have, on the whole, an energized church, which may do less, but it will run for longer. And I think be more empowered to do that. And we're all like that. In your ministry, the things that you're not very good at doing are the things that tire you out. The things that you're quite good at doing, if you're a preacher, you can preach all day. You may be physically tired, but you're energized. And you put in a ministerial situation, you're dead beat after half an hour. Yeah, we've got a guy in our church who's an administrator. He will sit in administrative meetings all day and night and think, "This is, give me another meeting." You're going, "Oh my word, what is the matter with this guy?" That's the way he's wired up. People have got to function in where they're wired. That's selection. Yeah, John.
What do you think?
Is this a trick question?
No, it's not. Following on from that question, what is the minimum that a church should do, and should draw a line and say, you know, we will not stop doing these things?
Yeah. I think this is what we talked about, the plumb line of the purpose statement, because that shapes you a little bit as to what you need to. It helps you say, this is our purpose. So at least everything has got to be functioning in that, because that will plumb us down a bit. The church needs to meet together, basically. And we need to be building a community. So how best we build communities, which is usually, the early church, it appears, on the whole, they didn't meet largely, but they also met in homes. So the concept of meeting in homes seems to be a pretty basic part of building community. The church is a community. Communities need to meet, they need to love one another, etc., etc. I think that's a minimum ingredient of church, is the church needs to be community, and we build it in the large, we build it in the small. And then the outworkings of that are often they're the things that keep the show on the road. The administration, the children's ministry, the youth ministry. You know, the whole idea of youth ministry, by the way, is a comparatively new idea. Since we invented teenagers, we invented a youth ministry. And we run those things because, and we pay for them, because we want our children looked after, we want them to grow up in the fear of the Lord, and we want our children to do the same. But it's purely our decision to do that. There's no mandate on it to be running children's work or youth work. It's just that we do it because that would help us. So those are things that are our own decision, really. They're not the basics of church, I think. Church is community. And provided we're functioning as a community, I think that's pretty well the basic minimum. I'm trying to think what else we might put into that category. Have you got some ideas, John?
No, I was hoping you would.
Church, ultimately, at its heart, the church is a community of people who love God, love one another, and love their God's world. So that's what it does. And then it has to fulfill its purpose. And I think what helps you to fulfill the purpose. But you could take the purpose, which is to make disciples and to grow disciples. It might be your purpose. But you could think of a million ways of doing that. So you'd have, again, you'd have to, yeah. You can only then do the things that emerge from the body of Christ. That's probably a limiting. Where the energy is coming from people to fulfill that purpose is going to be okay. Where it's coming from the front, this is going back to last night, and being dumped on people, that's going to cause strain. So that's a very fine balance, I think. And it is difficult. You've got a church, say, 200 people. Sunday morning service, you don't want the kids in the whole time, so they've got to be looked after. Who's going to do that? So immediately. But you also have to put back on the church, because we ran out of children's workers at one time. Said, okay, this is your issue, guys. They're your children. You don't want them here, you want them to be looked after. Fine, do it. If anybody is in this room and they've got children in the children's work and they don't want to be prepared to be involved in it, what is that about? Yeah. You know, you want them out there to be looked after. Why don't you be part of that service? So somehow the responsibility has got to go back on people rather than... we had a prayer meeting recently, an all half-night prayer, which was phenomenal. It was just one of the best things we've done for ages. But at the beginning of the meeting, the leader of the meeting, one of the pastors, stood up and said, "Thank you all for coming." And I said to the person afterwards, "Why did you thank everybody? You only thank people because they've come to please you, because you asked them to be there. You don't thank them. They've come to pray, for goodness sakes. That's their responsibility to pray. You can say it's great to all be together. Isn't it wonderful we're here? But when you say thank you, you're saying you have come to serve my hope and my vision," which is the language itself speaks volumes, doesn't it, to people. And I was very gentle about it, but I just said, I didn't need to be thanked for coming. I wanted to come. Because I wanted to pray. I want to thank you for organizing it. So I want to say, well done for you for organizing it. Don't thank me. I'm thanking you. Because I wanted to pray and you gave me a platform to pray. So I think continually having that sense of the body taking responsibility is so, so important, really. Yes?
So we've done a real good job at identifying and training and releasing pastor teachers. How do you think we can do the same with like evangelists and missional leaders?
Yeah, now, the Anglican Church will admit to you that the majority of Anglican vicars both are introvert and they're pastor teachers. Why have we got a problem of growth? There it is. And because that's what we see the church as a place to pastor. Let me just throw in a little bit here. I don't think, by the way, this is a little bit controversial, just to wake you up. I don't think, personally, we have a responsibility to pastor everybody in our church. I think we have a responsibility to make sure everybody in our church is cared for. The New Testament goes overboard to say we've got to one another it. One anothering it is the way the church is cared for. It's not the pastor's responsibility. Otherwise, everybody who joins your church, you think, oh my word, here comes another problem. And why should it be that someone joins your church, they join your church, and up to that point, they have never had a personal social worker, a personal psychiatrist, a personal whatever, and they join your church and they think, now, this pastor that I've joined this church is now responsible to look after me, visit me in hospital, see me when I'm sick, and care for me. Why, in heaven's name, is that suddenly the case? Now, I have a responsibility, it seems to me, to help you grow in Christ. So I'm going to challenge you, but I'm not going to come and nursemaid you in hospital. But I will make sure someone's come. I never visited people in hospital because I was awful at it. But if I did, people thought they were dying. That's the truth. But we had one lady, she started complaining to the whole church. She'd been in hospital, nobody ever visited her. So I inquired, and I found that 10 people had visited her. And I said to her, that's not true, 10 people have come. And her immediate response was, well, you never came. So she had to be retaught on that. But you're quite right. So somehow, most churches, David Watson used to say that 10% of every church have the gift of evangelist. I've not yet met a church, and I keep saying this, to say, why don't you get the evangelists together? Now, you may know who some of them are. If you come to our church, I will tell you who some of them are. They're people who, whenever we have an event, you don't even have to suggest they invite somebody. They've already done it. You know, they just do it. And there are certain people like that. They're just on the case. And there are others who are probably a bit more diffident, but you've spotted the fact that they may well have that gift. Actually, the most evangelistic people in the church are the evangelists and the new converts. So a church really ought to be saying, who are the people with that gifting? And we want to honour them. Of course, the gift of evangelism and leadership is, Ephesians 4 is to teach people how to be evangelists. So it's not to stand up and preach the gospel. It's actually to be a catalyst for evangelism. So that person, a really good evangelist in the church, inspires their friends and neighbours to also be reaching out. Now, there are people like that who need to be honoured. Now, then we move on to the apostolic gift, which is a bit more different. Now, we've backed off that in the church because we think it's rather, well, it's a bit arrogant, isn't it? Start thinking I might be an apostle. I mean, there were 12 of them, for goodness sakes, and Jesus handpicked those, and suddenly I'm saying I'm an apostle. It's the apostolic ministry, really. It's that ability to see into the future, into the vision, and be always pushing forward into new stages and things like that. And there are people like that in the church again. Now, if your leadership team does not contain that, you've got to find that. And this is basically Alan Hirsch. Have you read any of Alan Hirsch's books? He's written a whole lot of books. They're all the same, so it doesn't matter which one you buy. But no, not quite. But, you know, he's got a bee in his bonnet. And he talks about apostolic DNA. That is the only hope for the church, that we reignite apostolic DNA. So you've got to find people, like John here, who have got this continually thinking ahead, moving the church forward type of vision. If you haven't got it in the local church, then the likelihood is it's probably in a group of churches, or in a movement like this, or it might be even in your area. People, God has put them in the church, you've got to find them. But often we don't like to label them, we call them something else, we give them another name. It doesn't really matter about the name. But it is that thing that's going to push the church beyond where it is now. It's not just interested in pastoring and caring for people. There are people saying, we can't stay here. We've got to move on. We've got to pick. And they can be, if you're a pastor teacher, those people can be a bit in your face. So we try and ignore them a bit, push them on one side and give them a little project to do. But you're quite right. If we don't, and I'm not sure how to do this, but I think most movements, most organizations have got apostolic people. And you need them to be feeding into where you are and where you are as a church. I don't know if anybody wants to add to that. It's an important area, but I don't think we quite grasp it yet. But I think Alan's got a bee in his bonnet. And now the problem with him, he's a bit of a theoretician, actually. And so a lot of it is good theory, but you say, how does this actually work in my church? But we've got to find a way, because otherwise we will go back to this pastor-teacher thing. The man who stands up on Sunday is king. And that's what we've all come for, to be pastor and teacher. But the church has got to be further on than that, I think. And the prophetic gift is another one altogether. Yeah, thanks for asking the question. But we have to wrestle with that. You're quite right. And the other thing is, we need to help each other. I don't know if any of you have done this in your leadership teams, is actually sat down together and said, what do we see in each other? Let's be absolutely honest. You think you're the pastor teacher. The honest truth is, I don't think you are. I mean, that's, you know, that's true. And it's fantastic when a guy discovers that he's not actually a very good teacher. And then they get threatened because they think that's what I'm paid to do. No, you are called here for leadership. You're paid to do the thing that you're gifted to do. So if a guy can come up with the conclusion that he's the pastor of the church but he can't teach, that's a breakthrough. Yeah, but there must be somebody around here who can. Let's find some people in the church who've got a teaching gift. What a great, secure pastor who's able to stand up and say, this is not my primary gifting, but Fred and Jane, and they're going to be giving some teaching here. Fantastic. But what have you done is you've recognized in me something else. You've recognized that actually I really am an evangelist. So what I want to do is to be the person who spurs the church on into evangelism. That's my calling again. And because in the church we have assumed that the full-time leader is a pastor teacher. And how wrong that often is. And churches are often struggling because their pastor teacher isn't very good at, and people, he's not pastoring anybody. And they go, oh, there's no good at pastoring. We had a guy in Birmingham who was he's back in Birmingham now. As an Anglican vicar, he was a star evangelist. I mean, it's just fantastic. But the church got rid of him because he was hopeless at mission. He was not very good at pastoral care, and he was useless at administration. So they got rid of him. Unbelievable. They got gold dust in front of them. I didn't spot it. So then they hired in a guy who was a pastor teacher and a good administrator. If you go to that church today, people are pulling their hair out, thinking, what are we doing with this guy leading our church? Because they threw out the guy who should have been leading it. But they didn't weren't willing to say, that's his primary gift, let's bring somebody in alongside him to help with the administration, to help with the teaching. But honesty, if we're secure enough, we'll be honest. I don't want to be doing something that you guys don't think I'm very good at. I want to be doing the thing that God has gifted me to do. There must be something. Help! Okay, how are we doing? Five, couple more minutes, couple more questions. Sorry, run all the long answers. Yeah.
Nick, how have you, over your time, particularly when you were hitting those plateau moments, have you handled or resolved conflict, particularly at a governance level, not just within the church itself, but within kind of leaders or teams that particularly have different views on different things about maybe owning?
Yeah.
Responsibilities resolving some of that.
Oh, that's a very big question, Johnny. Johnny is a Liverpudlian, as you will hear, but he's moved to Birmingham because he recognises that that's really where God has centred himself. Actually, he's in Solihull. He's in the posh place.
Yes. How ironic.
He couldn't cope with it in Birmingham. He moved to Solihull. Solihull. That's such a big thing. Looking back on our church, I mean, where we made, you know, this curves and changes. God really, we never knew anything about curves and changes. We just did the things, and usually there was conflict at every point. We actually were in our early days, we split into congregations early on. We had six congregations meeting on Sunday morning. They were pretty chaotic, but we did grow quite rapidly for a time, and then we brought them back together again. And I did it too fast. I basically declared that I felt the Lord was saying, this is what we should do, and this is what we're going to do. She's got leaders together, so this is what we're going to do. We lost a whole congregation, who actually died after that. It fell apart. But it was partly their fault. They shouldn't have been rebellious, if you like, and done that. But on the other hand, I was very poor at actually taking them on board and helping them to understand why we were doing what we were doing and being patient with them. It was more, I felt, hey, God said it, let's do it. And now I would do it very, very differently, really. I would, and the other thing is that people who disagree with you in the point of change very often have something to teach you. And that's a incredibly important point. You think you're going to change something. Someone says, I disagree with it, and they've got an objection. And immediately you set them up as somebody who's against you. So we've got to deal with this person. They are objecting to these changes. Actually, hang on a minute. Can you just tell me what you said? I think you said it in not a very nice way, because you're feeling a bit defensive, but there might be something in what you're saying. I maybe need to listen to you. And I think I would do a lot more listening now than speaking, and respecting that the Holy Spirit is speaking through the body of Christ. Now, you can't be manipulated by that, but you should hear it, I think. What else? Because you may have a vision to do something or make a change, and you may be absolutely right, but the detail may not be right. So the fact that you're going to do it might be right. In other words, we may want to take the pews out, that's right, but we should have been putting bean bags in and not chairs. Are you with me? So we got part of it right, but we haven't got the detail. We should have gone back and said, this is what we think we should do. Now, help us with the process of this, guys. And it's not really answering your question, but it's trying to help that, you know, that is a struggle all the time. And you talk about the governance issues, which is more to do with the logistics of stuff. Because really, if you've got a governance team, the question they should be asking is not, shall we do this, but we're asking, can you help us how to do it? So an administrator should never be saying, sorry, you can't do that. It's not what you're paid to do, is to say, actually, I want to help you to know how to do it. You know, the word for administrator is the same word in the New Testament for pilot. And so if a ship is trying to get out of harbour, it doesn't say to the pilot, you're now the captain of the ship. It says, we've got to get out of this harbour, please show us the way out. Rather than say, you can't get out of here, there's got to be a way out of here, please show us the way out. And governance should be about that, I think. It should be about this sense of helping the leadership steer a course. Because very often visionaries just think you can just do it. It doesn't occur to them, these things cost money, and you've got to get engineers in, and you've got to do things practically. Because I walked into a church the other day, not far from us, Anglican church, and they really do need to refurbish the inside. And I said, it's quite obvious, as an outsider, you've got to do this, this, and the other. And the guy looked at me as if to think, oh, it's very easy for you to say that. Because he knows it's going to be this and this and this problem along the way. But that part of the vision is to say, yeah, I know this is what I want to do, but I have no idea how to get there. Can you guys please steer us through this? We know it's going to cost money, it's going to do, do, but please will you help us? Rather than saying, we're just going to do it, I think it's saying, we respect your gifting, please steer us on this course. Andrew.
You talked about the courage. I know for a lot of leaders and pastors, just mentioning the word change, you begin to a C, so it's like a C word.
Yeah.
And it just puts a sense of pressure on that. So where does the energy, how do you keep that energy going to maintain that part of your ministry is to be a change agent?
Yeah, if you read one of the chapters in the book, which actually my colleague wrote, he's a businessman who's seen a lot of changes in business. He talks about one of the key things is resilience. You've got to be resilient and keep going. I think the problem with the C word is probably best avoided. Probably best never to talk about change, but just talk about where you're going and what you're going to do. People will spot that it is a change. But the word change is actually quite a loaded word, I think. But I think we have to have resilience, really, to make it through, or you don't make it through. He talks about two things, energy and resilience. So you need to have energy that's going to engage and take you through the process. But you're going to have to be resilient to press on. Not in a stubborn way, we're going to do this, whatever you guys say. But a sense that if we're going to go through this change, someone's got to carry this. Because we know it's going to be okay in the end. We're willing to listen and do all the stuff we have to do and take the time and everything else. But someone has got to say, this is going to happen. And I think it's that resilience, really, which is not obstinacy or rudeness or any of those things. It's just a sense of, it's that Churchillian spirit, I suppose, that says we are going to win this. And, you know, never, 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 never give up. We're going to make it. But it has a humble heart that says, I may not have got it all right. I think the principle's right, but I may not have got the detail right, so help me, guys, with this. But, yeah, I think a lot of people have lost heart in change. Just too much hard work, to be honest with you, because it's just going to be an uphill battle. The other thing is, I think changes are better done in increments and not big steps. Big steps are frightening for people. And one of the things that Cotter says is get some short-term wins under your belt. And so, in other words, do something that is a short-term win that helps people to think it was okay. I put my toe in the water and it was all right. So I'm going to put my toe a bit further in the water. So it's worth working out when you're making a change, what would be a short-term win? What would demonstrate that we... on the pew thing, I'm sorry I keep going back to this, but I was in a church the other day and the guy said to me, we put one row of chairs out, and he said, the people who sit on them keep telling everybody how great it is. And it's like, for them, it's a short-term win. Interesting, I would tell you this, there's a lovely church in Middlesbrough, it's in Barnabas in Middlesbrough. If you ever go there, the church building is phenomenal, what they've done in terms of the woodwork and everything. Just made it stunning. It's a good church as well, it's a good building. I was up there last year, or the year before, and there was a lady came up to me, and we were just passing a time of day over coffee, an elderly lady, she was older than me, and I said, isn't this, I'm just saying what a fantastic building you've got. Huh, she said. I didn't think so at the beginning. I said, tell me. She said, you'll know my name. She said, talk to the vicar, he'll know my name. She said, when we went for this project, she said, I was not only against it, I was the leader of the band against it. I was fighting mad. I'd been in this church most of my life. And she said, I was really willing to give my life to keep these pews or whatever it was in the building. I said, fine. I said, and how do you feel about it now? Unbelievable, she said. It's wonderful. Wonderful. She said, I want you to know this. Whenever you go anywhere, and I haven't done this today, tell people, when they're going to make a change, they'll always meet people like me. But it's worth remembering. She said, I'm so glad they did it. It's a fantastic thing. So she said, there are people like me, but they're worth sticking with. I'm still in the church, she said, but I now think it's wonderful. And she was at the back. She would have been right at the back saying, don't do it. And that's a good heart, I think. So it's okay. But we have to be loving. Do not see people as the enemy. Understand who they are and where they're coming from. We have to love people through it and almost say, it's going to be okay, dear. Just keep with us. It's going to be okay. And you will all, I think it's true, every major change in our church life, we lost people. But it's not the end of the world. People find another church they do like. So what? You know, many people will tell you that they changed the style of their service, and some folks who love the traditional worship or whatever found another church down the road that had traditional worship. Win-win. You feel, oh, we lost some people. The kingdom didn't lose anybody. They're happy. You're happy. You can grow what you've got. Praise the Lord. It's time for lunch.